So, well, as always for me, it's an enormous pleasure to be in Bergen. I regard this as my second home, mainly because the weather here is exactly the same as it is at home, and sometimes I can't tell which city I'm in. Since I'm on first, I thought I'd take the opportunity to sketch a very general way that we might think about the relationship between the internet and broadcasting, and particularly public broadcasting. I was originally prompted to think about this when I was asked to give the Spry Lecture in Canada 3 years ago, which is a big public lecture dedicated to Graham Spry, who was one of the founding figures in pressing for public broadcasting to be instituted in Canada. So this is a sort of Mark II version of some of those ideas. There are two concepts which I'm going to return to. The first is the idea of the commons, but the second is the notion that in order to understand what's happening now, we have to understand it as a field of conflict between three moral economies: the economy of commodities, the economy of public goods, and the economy of gifts. First of all, the idea of the commons. I've always had a lot of problems with the idea of the public sphere. Most of the discussion about broadcasting and democracy, politics, privileges the idea of the public sphere. I prefer, in my own work, to use the notion of the commons. Two problems I have, we can argue about this, and if you wish to. I personally don't particularly, but if you want to come back in questions, please do. Two problems with the way that Habermas formulates it. First of all, as he puts it in his original formulation, the political public sphere is actually based on the literary public sphere, and yet he has very little to say about that first public sphere. For me, it's not just about deliberation. In order for people to engage in deliberation of any kind, they first have to have understanding and empathy with with other participants. And if you ask where does that come from, it comes primarily from fiction, from entertainment, from comedy. So when we're talking about broadcasting, the first thing to say is that we have to talk about the full range of programmers being central to a viable democracy. It's fiction where we go to find out about other people's lives, where we take imaginative walks, where we begin to imagine what it might be like to be somebody else, somebody totally different from ourselves. And so I wanted to find a concept that embraced not just notions of deliberation and political action, but also other forms of sociability, other forms of expressive contact. And so the word I've chosen, or the history I've chosen to privilege, is the history of the commons, which was originally, of course, applied to land, common land. And if you go to London, you'll still find the traces of that history: Wimbledon Common, Clapham Common. These were public spaces which were available, first of all, for people to supplement their economic livelihoods, gathering firewood, grazing sheep, and so on. But later, I think we can include all the great public institutions as being part of a public commons, particularly those that had free access: public libraries, museums, galleries, and adult education, for example. And finally, public broadcasting fits into this history very neatly. It was designed to be free at the point of use. It was designed to be open to everybody, to be simultaneously present in everybody's lives. So for me, the notion of the cultural commons is a kind of layered notion of a series of histories of public cultural spaces. However, there are three huge problems that have occurred in this history, which are very central to understanding what's happening now. First of all, the problem of enclosure. The original history of the commons as common land is also a history of the way it was enclosed, fenced off by commercial entrepreneurs who wished to claim it as private property during the great capitalization of agriculture. One of the things we see at the moment is the massive enclosure of cultural spaces around the world. Second problem is the problem of, we can use Foucault's term, problem of governmentality. If you look at the second layer of the history of the commons, public institutions, what you see is a huge and continuous struggle over whose culture should be privileged. And public broadcasting is very much part of that struggle. On the one hand, you have a concept of culture as a process of, as a 19th century phrase had it, gentling the masses, of creating rational citizens, of providing them with the information that they require to perform in a mass franchise society, but also forms of entertainment that would correspond with notions of what was called in the 19th century rational recreation. So there was a strong antipathy to spontaneous popular forms of expression. And you see that tension throughout. But there's also something else, something within the institutions themselves. Public broadcasting is often portrayed as a paternalistic force. And that's certainly one way to read the history. I think a more interesting way is to think about the contradictory nature of professionalism within public broadcasting. That all of these great public institutions were relatively, or designed to be, relatively autonomous. They weren't simply instruments of the state. They were personed by professionals who had their own concepts of what was appropriate, what was necessary. And that notion of professionalism as it cut across all the different activities had its own contradictions. On the one hand, it was very definitely intended as an educational initiative, in the best sense, in the original Latin sense of the term educare, meaning to lead out, the notion that the responsibility, and this is, I think, a responsibility that everybody in this room would share as an educator, the responsibility to give people the knowledge that they required to take control of their own lives, to understand their situation better, to think about the options that they had for intervening, for improving it, and so on. So that it's based on a knowledge that there's an inequality in the distribution of knowledge in society, and part of your professional responsibility is to close that gap, to give your knowledge away, to make it more freely available. But on the other hand, there's this constant political project of negotiating a mass democratic society. And in this sense, it's very important to understand the history of public broadcasting. It emerges at a very specific moment in time after World War I. You see, the 1920s are the key moment when public broadcasting around the world begins to solidify in many societies. There are three things about that period which have structured what has happened since. First of all, the introduction of mass forms of democratic participation. So that in Britain, for example, it's not until the late 1920s that women finally fully get the vote and you have a mass democracy based on one adult, one vote. So the problem of how do you manage this mass participation becomes an overriding concern. Secondly, it's the beginning of a mass consumer system. This is the first time you can say that for many people, just simply getting by is superseded by some notion of choice in consumption. You begin to get the development of the modern advertising system, of modern retailing, and so on. So the question of how do you manage consumption becomes an important issue. And finally, you have the domination of the United States in the field of popular culture. This is the age when Hollywood finally comes into its own, when the great European industries are on the retreat. It's the age of American domination in popular music, in jazz, and various forms of other popular music. The BBC, very early on in its history, commissioned an internal secret report, which was called The Octopus, which details all the tentacles of the American entertainment industry as they kind of found their way into British culture and kind of sucked on to the music and film industry and publishing and so on. And they were very, very worried about that. And that led to a paradox. It led to public broadcasting being nominated as the institution par excellence that would guarantee the continuity and vitality of something called national culture. It was national culture that had to be preserved against this mass assault from across the Atlantic. And you're finding in Canada the same argument. The slogan in Canada that won the day for public broadcasting was "Better the state than the United States." so you have these three sources of pressure, if you like: the management of mass participation, the management of mass consumption, and the protection and enhancement of national culture. And I think you can read the history of public broadcasting down to the present as a series of negotiations with these three great tensions. Remember, in a number of societies, public broadcasting was always a hybrid system. That is, public broadcasters from the beginning had to take advertising, in Australia, for example, because there was not a sufficiently large population to guarantee an income that was independent of commercial subsidy. So there was always a kind of, in many public broadcasting systems, an uneasy trade-off between the public part and the commercial part, between addressing people as citizens and addressing them as consumers. Now, that opposition, which I have to say for my shame I've had a part in promoting between citizens and consumers, is an important opposition. As a consumer, you're hailed, as Althusser would have said, you're addressed primarily as an individual who has a sovereign right to satisfy themselves in the marketplace. But as a citizen, you're addressed as a member of a moral and political community, which involves not only rights for you personally, but responsibilities for the common good, responsibilities for the quality of collective life. Consumerism is not worried about that. Indeed, the whole point of advertising is to project your attention forward, to get you to think about how wonderful it will be when you possess the object that's being promoted, and to get you to forget where it's come from and how much it's cost in social and environmental terms. Recovering that lost history, of course, was one of Marx's great projects. That's why he begins Capital with a massive chapter on the commodity and what he calls the fetish of commodities, which is precisely this amnesia, the fact that commodities appear to have no history, that they come from nowhere. But I want to introduce a third term. I don't like thinking in dualities, and this is a paradox. Whether I still call it digitalization, maybe, you know, I don't mind that. In the digital age, of course, one thinks in dualities, zero, one, on, off, yes, no, there, not there. But I grew up in a quasi-religious family where I always was taught to think in threes, because in the Christian faith, the doctrine of the Trinity is absolutely central. Now, I always had a problem with this. I could understand God the Father, big guy, long beard and so on. God the Son, yes, Jesus. But then there was this other thing, the Holy Ghost. What the hell was that? I mean, it's slippery, it's everywhere, it's nowhere. I could never understand it. And as I traveled through social sciences, I realized there was always a Holy Ghost in all of the conceptual machines which I dealt with. So, for example, we understand capital and we understand the saint. They're very solid. But what is civil society? Civil society is another one of these slippery things. I mean, it's everything that's not capital or the state. So it includes sports clubs, it includes Al-Qaeda. You think, well, is this really a useful concept? And in political economy, we come to the same conclusion. Commodities, we know what commodities are, we know what public goods are. But there's also a third economy, the economy of gifts, which I'll come back to in a minute. So I want to introduce a third term alongside consumer and citizen. Very difficult, because of this slippery nature, it's very difficult to find a good way of describing this. But the term that I use in my own work now is communards, which I borrowed, of course, from the French Commune when people of Paris created their own institutions. So we're simultaneously occupying three positions and shifting between them. We're all citizens, we're always consumers, but I think in many ways we're also communards. We're engaged in voluntary activities, we're engaged in creating things from the bottom up, we're engaged in all kinds of associations which kind of escape from the official logic of citizenship. And these correspond, I think, with three kind of political economies. The economy of commodities, the economy of public goods, and the economy of gifts. So that what you see is a very, if you look now at the cultural arena, you see a very complex playoff between those three economies and the way they circulate, and the three identities which they encourage people to take on. Now, gift economies are, that's the ghost in the machine. Gift economies are, for a long time, were thought to be primarily a property of tribal societies. And there's a huge anthropological literature on the gift in all of its forms. It comes to pretty much a pessimistic conclusion, or the modern variants represented by anthropologists like Marion Strathern and Pierre Bourdieu's work in North Africa. Gifts are a weapon. Gifts are a way of exercising power. Gifts are a way of claiming status. So then they're actually the anthropological kind of common sense now is that gifts are a power articulation. But there's another literature on gifts which has come out in terms of understanding the role of gifts in contemporary complex capitalist economies. We haven't got time to get into that, but it's a very interesting literature. But if you look now at the original philosophy of the internet, the so-called hacker ethic, it's a classic gift economy. And it revolves not around prices. Commodity economies revolve around prices. You get what you pay for. Public good economies revolve around taxes. That is, you pay money in order to have centrally provided goods that are collectively valued. So that, and I use public good in two senses. In the strict economic terms, a public good is any good that I can enjoy without interfering with your enjoyment. So, for example, public broadcasting has always been a public good, whether it was publicly funded or commercial, because everybody can watch a broadcast or listen to a broadcast without interfering with each other. That's very different from a cinema ticket. We can't both sit in the same seat at the same time unless we have, as I do, of course, with your seat, a very special relationship. But it's the notion of exclusivity. But there's also another sense, that a philosophical sense, that public goods are contributing to the collective good in a much more general way, that we value them even if we don't use them ourselves, because we believe that they contribute to a more civilized society. So, for example, even if you don't have children, you don't have an objection to paying taxes for schools because you believe that educating children and young people will lead to a more civilized and pleasant society to live in. Gift economies are based on reciprocity. So let's take an example like Wikipedia. I put up an entry on Wikipedia on something I know about. I don't ask you to pay anything for it. But we enter into a kind of unwritten contract that you in turn will contribute something in an area that you know about. So we exchange expertise, we exchange our knowledge. Now, if we look at the internet, what we see is all three of those economies running simultaneously. And I think part of the history and future of the internet will be about the way they balance out. So you can see three things going on at the moment, which are actually very interesting. First of all, a massive extension of enclosure. We're seeing the greatest enclosure movement since the 18th century. But you're also seeing two other things. You're seeing a revivification of public goods, and you're seeing a massive explosion of gift relationships. Let me just go through those very briefly in turn. Commodification and enclosure. Corporations have finally woken up to the fact that the internet could be a very, very, very valuable source for generating income. They were relatively slow to understand that. If you look at the history of Rupert Murdoch, for example, and his initial skepticism and hostility, now rushing to grab everything he can. So you see the acquisition of facilities and their commercialization. But you see also other things. You see a massive expansion of copyright in the last 20 years. You see the amount of material that has been brought into the copyright system in some form or another enormously increased. So you see more and more things that used to be available are now fenced off and are now being charged for on a price system. That's a fairly familiar story and a very predictable one. But you also see the revivification of public goods, public institutions. That one of the great problems that a public institution like a museum or a library had was that it was a physical institution. You had to physically go there in order to access any of the material. But even when you got there, you might not be able to get all of it, because most of it was held in store. So if you go to one of the world's great museums, there's far more in the basement than there ever is displayed. It's just a very, very small selection. But one of the things that digitalization has allowed museums and libraries to begin to do is to make all of their material available. So for example, the Tate Gallery can finally make all the paintings of the great British artist Turner available. In Turner's will, he left everything he ever drew or painted to the nation. But you would actually have to build a gallery half as big as London to accommodate Turner's collection. It's a gigantic oeuvre of stuff. But digitalizing it allows it to be accessible in a way that's never been possible before. So you see a great revolution going on in the great public institutions as they begin to digitalize their material. Now, there are problems with this that we'll come back to. It's not a pure process. So, for example, the Bodleian Library in Oxford, along with a number of other great public libraries, have signed a deal with Google. Google will digitalize their collection, but access to that collection will be ring-fenced in certain ways. If you go to the Bodleian Library, you can look at any book you like. You can look at it for as long as you like. You can flip backwards and forwards through it. You can go and get another book. If you go to the electronic site, you can't do that. If the book is still in copyright, you can only see a small part of it, and then you're directed to where you can buy the book for yourself. So in fact, the digital process has restricted access in a way that it doesn't in the physical library. But even with those caveats, you see an enormous explosion of access to materials. And finally, you see this enormous, what some people call Web 2, although I think that makes it look like it's chronological. This potential's always been part of the web, but the latest increases in technology, particularly the expansion of broadband technologies and the massive increase in computer speeds and power, make it much more easy to do this. So it's become easy to transmit audio-visual material in a way that wasn't possible before. But what you see is an enormous explosion of vernacular activity. You see new kinds of communities forming. You see these exchanges of information on a reciprocity basis. There's a wonderful site that you can go to find the best seat on any aeroplane flying currently anywhere in the world. This has been built up by users of aeroplanes. There are many such recommendation sites, the best hotel, the best place to eat, and so on. They're all coming from the bottom up, and they're constantly being modified by people chipping in. There's Wikipedia, there's blogging, there are vernacular archives of all kinds. So you have another enormous repository. Now, public broadcasting. Public broadcasting is in a way at the center of this. It's caught in the eye of the storm, because throughout its history it's been expected to be a museum without walls, a library without walls, a classroom without walls. It's been the place where all those public initiatives would find a mass way of distributing themselves. But it's also been constantly assaulted by pressures from enclosure and pressures coming up from underneath for greater representation. And historically, those have been very, very difficult to contain. So that one of the histories you can write of broadcasting is the history between professional judgments about what is appropriate in programming and initiatives from pressure groups demanding greater representation, greater participation, and greater access to the camera, and so on. What I think you see now is an intensification of the commercial push to annex public broadcasting, to enclose it. You see that in all sorts of ways. You see greater pressure on public broadcasters to maximize the revenue from their activities. So that you find in many organizations a kind of double-facing organization. You find the old national broadcast, but you find another division which is in charge of international sales, format sales, merchandising. These guys are businessmen. These guys are used to working in the market. Now, the idea is that the money made from those activities will be plowed back into programming, but it institutes very centrally within the organization a double culture, a commercial culture, which is no longer just a fiction, it's part of the way the organization works. And it's becoming increasingly part of one of the criteria by which new program projects are evaluated. Do they have merchandising potential? Can the format be sold? What are the sales potentials, and so on? So broadcasters themselves are kind of caught in this movement. But there's something much more fundamental going on if you read the documents, particularly documents coming out of the EU and out of the new British national regulator, Ofcom. That is that public broadcasting is seen to be both an institutional formation but also a programming menu. And there's an increasing push to separate the two. The argument goes like this. Yes, there are market failures. The market will not produce all the kinds of programs that a mature democracy requires. Even the most convinced marketeers admit that. Indeed, they're quite happy to say that's the case. So there's a space for another form of production that would compensate for those commercial failures, or would make programs that were either not commercially viable or not profitable enough. But the question goes, you don't need public broadcasting institutions to make those kind of programs. Why not have a production fund that anybody can bid for? They want to make an investigative documentary about Iraq. Why do the public broadcasters have to monopolize this? This is unfair competition, surely. So what we should do is we should get rid of the public broadcasters, or we should allow them to become subscription services. It's another contradiction that public broadcasters face. The more successful they are in getting extra commercial revenue, the less convincing their argument for a monopoly of public subsidy becomes. And you hear people say this all the time, say, oh, well, actually, you turned out to be very good at selling to America. That's very, very good. You won't need any public money anymore then, will you? So they're caught in a kind of ratchet which they can't get out of. But the real ambition is to actually say that public broadcasting isn't really about expensive institutions. It's about public service programming. And that could appear anywhere. It could appear on your mobile phone. It could appear, you know, on an implant you've got on your hand or whatever. It's about particular categories of programming, and they don't have to be made by public broadcasters. Now, I think that argument's going to gather in momentum. So how can public broadcasters position themselves in this very difficult situation? My argument is that this is the moment in time when public broadcasters can finally make a really convincing argument for their indispensability as institutions. But in order to make that argument, you've got to make a fundamental imaginative leap. You've got to say that public broadcasting is not only, or perhaps not even primarily, about programming. It's about all the resources that public broadcasters can give access to for free. So that what happens behind the screen is as important, and I think in the future will be more important than what is actually on the screen. You can already see that if you look at the BBC. The BBC's website gets far more hits than its viewing figures would predict. There are lots of people who use the facilities on the website who actually don't watch the programs. That's okay. They're still getting an advantage from that public subsidy. So what is it that public broadcasters can offer? Well, let's look at some of the problems, structural problems, that you've got with the internet, as it is at the moment. First problem is that access remains for most people primarily through a computer screen. There are still massive inequalities of access. I've just finished a big project on this. They're primarily related to income, but they're also related to age. In Britain, there's a substantial proportion of the population, let's say between 20 and 25%, who simply do not have access to the internet. And that figure's not going down. It's a structural problem. It's not a question of it eventually catching up. That's a lot of people to throw away. Television, on the other hand, particularly with elderly people, television is a technology that they're very familiar with, they feel very comfortable with, it's already part of their everyday life. Indeed, for many elderly people who are housebound, it is the only thing that they have contact with. So that accessing facilities through the television set is much less threatening, much more familiar, much more readily available to them. Second thing is that one of the fundamental problems of the internet and of multi-channel television is the segmentation of attention. One of the fundamental principles of a democratic society is that dialogue has to take place across borders. We have to confront opinions that we personally find unpalatable. We have to negotiate across the most difficult borders, politically, morally, philosophically. There has to be a genuine attempt to develop a way of working or balancing out conflicts. One of the consequences of the explosion of channels and of the way the internet's developed is that it's now possible only to look at those things that you know you will already like, and only to have contact with those people you know you will already agree with. So that you have a radically segmented polity emerging. That, I think, is incredibly dangerous. So we need to rebuild a common space. We need to have somewhere where there's a dialogue across borders, where there's a convergence of interest. Public broadcasting, I think, has been historically one of those places where that has happened. But it needs to be addressed again in the light of what's happening now on the internet. The final thing, I think, which is very important to remember, and because I had a historic interest in terrorism, I gave it up now, but don't worry, you're perfectly safe. All the digital technologies are also co-opted into an increasingly comprehensive system of surveillance. It's something that's not often mentioned, but it's of fundamental importance. Every click on the keyboard, every time you use your mobile phone, is potentially an element of information in an increasingly complex transnational surveillance system. So they're instruments of control as well as instruments of personal choice. That's very, very important. The question of what happens to the information that you provide by using commercially based technologies, I think, is a fundamental issue for human rights. Who will have access to that information? I think one of the things that a public institution can guarantee is that information will not be accessible. It's not just the state, it's also commercial operations. One of the great enthusiasms in marketing at the moment is indeed the personalization of marketing. The more they know about you, the more targeted they can become in terms of reaching you. So there are, for example, to take a very simple example, mobile phones are a locational device. They can locate you on the Earth's planet very precisely. There are experiments to download advertisements. You might be passing the local McDonald's. Suddenly you get a little text message that says, hey, did you know McDonald's is offering 5 for $4 today? You know, why don't you pop in? You think, oh, yeah, all right, maybe I'll do that. This is the world we're now inhabiting. It's not just about state collection of data, it's these massive commercial databases. We need to be very careful about that. But the other thing I think that's very important is that broadcasting is trusted. Public broadcasting, even when people say they don't watch very much, they actually trust public broadcasters in a way that they don't trust commercial organizations. They have very high ratings of trust. That's a symbolic capital that's incredibly useful. It's almost impossible to accumulate. Companies find it very difficult to win those levels of trust. One of the key problems in the future will be the way that access to the explosion of information that is coming up on the internet is organized. If you take, for example, you wanted health information, if you dial up any of the big search engines, most of the sites that will come up will be in